Welcome to the Men Among Demons podcast.
In a disoriented world, this is the podcast that asks what would happen if we truly put Christ at the center of our thinking.
I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Opperwall.
And I'm your host, Dr. Greg Wiebe.
Hi, Greg.
Hey, man.
Well, we have a lovely special guest for this episode.
This month, some right? Say the loveliest and specialist.
Some say. Aww. I might go so far as to say that because our special guest is my beautiful wife, Eleni. Hi, Eleni.
Hi, guys. That's a very sweet intro.
Welcome to the Men Among Demons podcast. We're bringing in the family now. Eleni, we thought we'd have you on because you and I have had some really interesting conversations since the last episode of Men Among Demons dealing with psychedelics, and we can maybe springboard off that a little bit towards continue conversation about that as part of what we are interested in, but also mental health more broadly and like what that means and interactions of body and mind and that kind of thing. But in order to maybe explain to listeners why you're here, other than you being just a wonderful person and a great wife, you have some qualifications on these topics that are a little more than just that. So why don't you tell us just a bit about who you are?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I am a therapist by trade. I got my MSW way back in the year 2007. Doesn't seem like that long ago, but that was shortly after we were married. And basically started off in the field in terms of looking at attachment theory, working with parent-child relationships, graduated from University of Michigan. And then my very first job was in Detroit. We were living in Midtown at the time. I was working at an agency called the Children's Center for that first year. I believe my salary before taxes was a whopping like $30,000 when I first started out. I started with like incredibly vulnerable families as kind of a baptism by fire. So I was working in what was known as an infant mental health program, doing home visits to families with like infants or toddlers, kind of trying to foster an attachment relationship between parents and very young children. So there were a lot of people who thought that I was essentially CAS. There were some people who thought that, you know, I was there to like take their kids away. You know, I would show up on the block sometimes and there would be like burnt out building, one building with lights on, burnt out building. And that was like the building with lights on was my family. And so, just thrown right into it in a lot of ways, and learned an incredible amount about human beings and trauma during that time, and some of the ways that people respond to being wounded in various ways, both on a societal level in terms of their communities and also interpersonally, especially childhood wounds related to trauma. So so that was my first job. And then once we moved to Canada, continued working in community mental health, working with kids and families. To me, I kind of working with kids was sort of an excuse to stay in the world of play, and dealing with things like imagination, fantasy, all of the good stuff, right? So so I got to do that for quite a few years. I spent the better part of a decade doing that before I shifted to private practice, which happened for me during the COVID times. Like a lot of mental health workers, the switch to exclusively virtual kind of brought some blessings and some curses. And some of the blessings were just that it became a lot easier to launch a private practice. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to pay for an office. So, you know, in many ways, vertical therapy has not been, wasn't ideal during that time. But it also did provide some accessibility for people who might not be able to get into the office, and also kind of created a segue for those of us who might want to launch into some private work. So that was my shift after I had done kind of my time at community mental health, which is just the jungle of mental health services. Yeah, and so I've sort of continued. I think trauma has been sort of a through line throughout my career in terms of interests. I continue to get to a point where I would be working with modalities that were more cognitively based, you know, trauma-focused CBT, for example, cognitive behavioral therapy. You're looking at thinking traps. You're looking at patterns in behavior. Looking at mental health from sort of a very mental cerebral standpoint. And repeatedly, I would smack into a barrier of some kind, like a wall. We would get so far and then we would be stuck. And what I came to realize was that the wall was the felt sense of the body. And so this kind of came to a head for me once I launched my own private practice, which was focused more on postpartum women. And some of the work that I was doing was with birth trauma, which is a very somatic, all trauma is connected to the body because we have bodies. We're bodily beings mm-hmm. in a physical way. All of our experiences leave some kind of physical imprint. But with birth trauma, because the trauma is so somatic in nature and happens within a person's very body, mm-hmm. the sense for me was that it wasn't going to be possible to sort of use the language of like working with the mind or with cognition to approach something that was so intensely somatic. So one of the things that I kind of did during that time was getting my training in EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which I think Dan had mentioned in one of the previous podcasts, as basically a form of therapy that looks at reintegrating the sort of different forms of different ways of perceiving information from the outside world that each human being has. So if you think about thoughts, emotions, and bodily sensations as kind of three centers of intelligence. We gain information from our emotions, we gain information from our thoughts, we gain information from our physical sensations. Oftentimes in traumatic situations or after trauma, those become fragmented. And so instead of operating together as a well-run committee, they stop communicating with each other, and one becomes sort of overly reactive or kind of takes center stage, right? Mm-hmm. So people might become very, very stuck on the level of their body, bodily sensations. Maybe there's chronic pain. Maybe there are physical reactions in their nervous system that they feel escalating in a way that is beyond their control. You know, they drive by a site where the trauma took place, their heart is beating, they begin breathing shallowly, they're sweating. Your cognition sometimes can also kind of begin running the show in terms of, you know, we have running scripts and traps in our thoughts that determine then you know, what we might be doing in a way that might not be healthy for us. Or sometimes our emotions are very, very sort of run the show, right? We become extremely quickly reactive in ways that are harmful, right? So in the context of EMDR, what was reintegrate all of these fragmented pieces into a coherent whole, which I would say is sort of the definition of health.
That's interesting. Thanks for the introduction too, by the way. Really useful. I'm jumping in there. Well, partly I think you were wrapping up, but this was the piece that I found interesting in our follow-up conversations about the last episode, which is on psychedelics. that question of integration and mind-body connection really at the center of some of these issues. But you seemed, in our conversations anyway, a little bit skeptical about certain aspects of the sort of psychedelic approach that we talked about last month. I think it's sort of related to what you're saying there, but I wonder if you could say a little more about some of your hesitations with respect to that in this mind-body nexus that we inhabit.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the first thing I'd want to say is that, like, I would like to create some distinctions between the different uses of psychedelics, because I think that, you know, on the one hand, we have kind of microdosing for medical purposes, which is going to be like that to me within the next like 5 to 10 years is going to be pretty standardized, I think, and probably available in the same way that SSRIs are widely available, you know, and that's wonderful. And there's clear benefits to that. You know, many people
are there.
I think the initial, we don't have a ton of research yet, but the initial,
it's a strong statement. There's got this
Well,
I'm not saying that you're wrong.
Yeah. I would say some of the preliminary research seems to be promising.
Okay. I can accept.
Yeah. Father Jeffrey brought up some of the applications related to things like people on the autism spectrum, people who have had PTSD or other who have experienced trauma in some way. So I think I'm that to me is sort of a separate thing. That's in the same category as things
medical
like SSRIs,
reasons,
medical reasons, right?
Research,
so, yeah, that's something that I think will become kind of increasingly, probably quite normal. We're very certainly not aware of like all of the side effects of that quite yet, and we will come to be, right? In the same way that in the 1980s, SSRIs were the miracle drug that was going to fix everyone's problems, and like, gee whiz, this is wonderful that we have this amazing thing. You know, we're going to find also that it, as with most psychiatric medications, there's sort of a third split in terms of about a third of people, it feels incredibly life-altering and changing in a significant way. About a third of people gain some benefit from it, but, you know, it's a piece of the puzzle and not the whole puzzle. And a third of people will feel that, you know, it either it didn't make any difference or it made a negative difference. The side effects were not tenable. So my guess is that that's going to follow essentially the same split that we've seen for the vast majority of psychiatric medications. And yeah, that's one potential piece of the puzzle for some folks, right? So medical use is one piece. Right. That I'm quite content for there to be research around that and for it to be treated in the same way that any kind of psychiatric medication would be treated. Another use we could say is like recreational use, which like I wouldn't really recommend, you know, in the sense of like, hey, let's all just like trip out and have a really good time. Right. Like, yeah, whatever. There's ways to have a good time with your friends that maybe don't involve using psychedelics. We can. I don't think that's what we're talking about either. So let's clear both of those things aside. And we can focus exclusively on spiritual use of psychedelics, which is really what we were talking about, I think, as being something that I think is a fascinating conversation that is coming up more and more for me in my practice, actually. And just in general society, there are more and more people who are really interested in having a mystical experience, but not closely connected to any particular faith community or tradition that would connect them to that. And so psychedelics are something that people are turning to with like increasing frequency. And I've had like, you know, friends have described their own. I had told you, Dan, I have a close friend who had a spiritual experience on ayahuasca and saw the Theotokos and like
Jabers. Well, like, what do you make of that? What it like, so what do you make of that? like wanting to have, like, what does that mean? Wanting to have a mystical experience, like for like a client to come and be like, I want to have a mystical experience.
Yeah.
Like there's a lot of questions, like where, like, what do you mean? And where have you heard about this? So like, what do you think that you're asking for? Like all of that stuff.
Yeah. Those are really important questions, I think. Like the question of what is a mystical experience? I think, you know, we have some sense, you know, within Eastern Orthodoxy of like a mystical mm-hmm. experience as being a direct apprehension of God or an aspect of God. Right.
Possibly. But not inherently. I mean, certainly in the tradition, there's plenty of negative mystical experiences. You
know, people definitely
encountering the devil himself. You know?
Vast, vast majority of my clientele are the nuns, right? So not nuns as in female monastics, but nuns as in N-O-N-E-S. They have no religious affiliation or identity to speak of, right? And so, you know, and some of these people are like experimenting with like, okay, I go to this, you know, I had one who attended like an official psilocybin ceremony. Everybody goes on a mat. Somebody's like playing music and drums like in the corner for 5 hours. Somebody else is up front making sure everybody's like physically okay. Right. And
it's already highly ritualized and
yes,
ceremonial. Yeah.
Which I think to me is incredibly significant. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think is fascinating about the desire to have this mystical experience is that even with the use of psychedelics, which have become so reified as the source of mysticism, we still need to create all of this ritual around it.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. In the church, we already have all of that, right? We, you know, you could say like, okay, well, we don't have these psychedelics in it, but are the psychedelics the most important part of, you know, these rituals that people are doing? I mean, you know, it's debatable, right? That like, there's so much about the ritual itself that to me opens up all of these other dimensions of like human experience, right? So, you know, that need for ritual as part of mysticism, I think, is a really deep human need. Mm-hmm. You know, we in the church already have a really rich tradition of mysticism. We have hesychasm. Mm-hmm. Right? And we're about to celebrate St. Gregory Palamas. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a really significant part of our identity as Orthodox Christians in the East. You know, that gives us a whole tradition to tap into already surrounding like mystical experiences. And I think it's interesting, we've had some discussions, Dan, about like, what are some of the ways that mystical or ecstatic experiences have been approached within that tradition as a foil to some of the ways that like psychedelics are being approached these days, right? Like,
it's interesting to me because you're pointing, I think, rightly to community, connection, ritual. These things are very important in Orthodox Christian life. In the sacrament, we would add to that, which is the ritual, the ultimate sort of ritual. And as significant, but you're also mentioning people who, you know, you might be working with or people you just know or whatever. I mean, these are not all clients even necessarily, who are looking for something, like looking for spiritual, like fireworks, special effects, right? Like they're looking for something more than, you know, come to our parish church on Sunday.
Yeah.
If someone comes to our church on Sunday, they are probably not going to have like a vision of Jesus standing in front of them in like bright glowing light. I mean, they right. might
be quite something.
It can happen. That would be quite something. The stories,
yeah.
But like, it's like, don't expect that. But it's like, it sounds like, it doesn't just sound like, I think we've all run into this kind of thing, but you even much more than I have run into people who are really craving that. Like, no, it's not yes. good enough for me to come and have a ritual
yeah.
and have a community around me and yeah. have, you know, all these supports and create a rhythm and a pattern in my life and all that stuff, which is really the heart and soul of Orthodox Christian life, certainly mm-hmm. at the parish level. But they want the special effects and the fireworks. And this is the part that, you know, I was getting snagged on in our last conversation. No. You and I have been getting snagged on, like that desire for the fireworks.
Yeah.
Is that should we want that? I want to say we shouldn't want that.
St. Augustine talks about that. He does literally talk. Oh yeah, in his. I'm trying to think about. It's in his. I didn't pay that much attention to it when I was doing the research and writing. But it's in his commentary on the epistles of on the first epistle of John. Yeah, like this right. that desire to have a mystical experience, that desire to have like a vision, like to have a vision of God or have a vision, like is exactly a temptation, a kind of that participates in the devil appearing as an angel of light, right?
Right. So and to me, it's really significant that like many of the people who, you know, you read stories in the Philokalia all the time of people to whom angels have appeared, who have seen the uncreated light, who have spent all of this time, you know, meditating upon the prayer of the heart to the point that it actually resonates with their heartbeat. They breathe it, they live it, and they go totally fucking crazy. And like something happens to them, they throw themselves down a well, right? Like there are stories like that all the time. So we also have to approach the mystical experience from a place of really knowing that we're entering into something a bit wild and that right. there are boundaries and parameters uh-huh. that the church provides that create some kind of purposeful intention around what's going on. Like one of the things that I had said to you in one of our recent conversations, Dan, is that in the mysteries of the church, like what's the very first mystery for every Christian? We have baptism, right? Mm-hmm. And the beginning of that is what?
Exorcism.
The exorcism. We start by basically saying, you know, there are parameters around this particular thing that we're about yeah. to do.
Gotta
and
clear
it's
space.
Not short. It like goes on for a long time. People who are not Orthodox mm-hmm. come to a baptism and they get uncomfortable because we spend a ton of time basically being like, you know, Satan and any, you know, evil powers are banished from the general vicinity of this person, from the water into which they are about to enter, from the yeah. person's heart. You know, it's very clear, like what we are about to do is lower you into like another dimension. And there's like snakes whose heads need to be crushed. There's dragons in there. There's like all of this nasty, nasty stuff. And so like the first thing you do is create some boundaries because good fences make good neighbors. And so, you know, mm-hmm. when we're...
I don't think I like that metaphor with demons. Good fences just keep out demons, maybe. About really bad. Like,
I sort of think I don't know what
I take your broader point for sure.
I don't know what you think about this, Greg, but sometimes I think of you're the resident demon guy, so I'll run this by you. But sometimes I like to think of demons as like really shitty angels, like just uh-huh. like, they end up sometimes doing God's work, but in like the most roundabout, unwilling right. way. So they're just like really bad at their job. There's lots of shitty angels in there that could like be messing with us, right? And so the first thing we do is we create parameters and we are very yeah. intentional about, like, you know, we breathe and spit, yeah. right? Like there's particular things that we do at the outset before we even enter into this experience. you know, obviously most people are not having spiritual visions of like the Lord talking to them or seeing the Theotokos, like my friend or whatever, seeing like other, I've had clients see other creatures. I had a client see an ent-like figure, like a talking tree.
Right, sure.
I had one client who saw a vision of Kuan Yin, I believe is the name of the figure. It's like a female Buddha of compassion. Like, there's, so, like, we're not visually seeing those things, but to some extent we acknowledge that we're entering into another realm in which those things are present, whether we see them or not. Right.
Yeah, they're part of the thing is, yeah, the thing is that our faith tradition doesn't deny the existence of alternate of a variety of spirits, a variety of created spirits,
sure,
that are associated with all aspects of creation.
Right. Yeah. Right?
So there's that sort of goes back to like the point that just a moment ago you were that we were touching on, that also touches on where we started the conversation with Father Jeffrey, which was the very meaning of the term that apparently we use instead of psychedelics, which I couldn't remember that entire episode, but I feel like I recall now, which is entheogens.
Entheogens, right? Oh, no.
Entheogens. Entheogens, which of course, right, means like, part of it, it's etymologically related to enthusiasm, which is right, that entheos is that if comes from in, like, whatever, being in the god, right, and into a divinity, or like being whatever the actual imagery is, whether you're, you know, being immersed or being taken up, but like there's an invocation here that there is deity, but of course we recognize a variety of deities. There is, right, only one true God and only one true Most High Godhood that is shared fully coequally by the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. But there are a variety of powers in the cosmos that are created to participate in that divinity and be sons of God, be shepherds of the heavenly realms, that some of which have fallen, right? And so the point is, if you're opening yourself up, like, it does feel like the recurring pattern is that okay, I want to look for a mystical experience, I want to experience divinity, right? And okay, we can use sort of meditative technology or ritual technology, or these days what we're talking about is like there's chemical technology, plant chemical technology, right, of psychedelics, of entheogens. And it seems like the way all of these things work is just a basic opening up.
Right.
It's an opening of the door.
Yes.
And you cannot control what comes through. And maybe in most cases nothing comes through. Maybe it's just a hot breeze or whatever the experience, however you imagine the experience when the door opens, but occasionally things do come through. And it's like, it feels fundamentally risky to me, because you don't know whether what's coming through is going to be holy and have good intentions or not. And I think the way we think about these things is not that. Like, we tend not to think about our spiritual world as though God and the good angels are always standing by, making sure that nothing bad ever happens to his creation. That's not how we construe our spiritual life. The angels always have power over the fallen angels. You know, we confess by tradition, but that's not like, that doesn't literally mean that if you open your door, that you're not taking a risk. There's always some. Right. There's always these other things that can come through.
Absolutely.
But I don't know. Like, what do you?
It seems to me that the intensity of that opening, and I don't have direct experience, so I mean, maybe I have no business talking about it at all, really. But I'm not going to go get the direct experience. I have no intention of taking mushrooms.
Yeah.
But it, certainly from other people's descriptions, it seems that the intensity of that is very high, which is the appeal, I gather, but is also a reason to be a little bit not even just a little bit, potentially a lot wary about it, right? Like very wary about it.
Right.
Because yes, people have experiences from meditating. Yes, people have experiences from fasting and just staying up really late. They do. But from the descriptions I've had with people who've had mystical experiences of that nature, they tend to just be, there tends to be a little bit more of a, I don't know, a clear divide, maybe like mentally, cognitively, even physically, like neurologically almost, sort of the difference between a, you know, a dream. Like people have dreams too, right? Like we all kind of trip out a little bit when we're dreaming, but it's not like a dream just doesn't have the edge that people seem to describe with some of these experiences that are just so overwhelming. Because you're awake and it's extremely intense. And so, yeah, so maybe you see a kind of some sort of vision while meditating. But my sense is that those things are a little, well, made a little less dangerous by being a little less intense, right? It's not going to be as overwhelming. If an angel of light appears to me in a dream that I kind of vaguely remember tomorrow morning versus me having an experience where, like, in my reality, you know, an angel glowing light is like just as real to me as like the, you know, the table or you sitting in front of me. It's a difference in degree at the end of the day, but sometimes differences in degree can become a difference in kind in terms of the processing of it and the kind of potential spiritual risk it creates is my sense.
Well, here's the huge difference to me, Dan, is that the one, like entering into a dream, or even if you have a spiritual vision, which happens to lots of people while they're just going through their day and, you know, there's no psychedelics involved, right? That's something that the difference between that and presenting yourself with a psychedelic experience is a difference in terms of intention. And what I find is that for most of the folks that I talk to who have, you know, taken one of the so-called entheogens, which is a term that I have major reservations about, but we can talk about that too. But for anybody who has taken one of, you know, a psychedelic substance, one of the purposes or one of the reasons that kind of brings people to this is something that has been around since ancient times, since the Oracle at Delphi, which is divination, right? People are stuck in some way. And Father Jeffrey alluded to this. People get stuck. They feel that they need some kind of guidance, you know, like all of us who are sometimes just like, God, give me a sign. But the added step is that you then are like, I'm going to take this thing and then I'm going to get my sign. It.
Yeah.
So to me, that creates a bit of a vulnerability because you're coming to this with an expectation. And again, there's just that spiritual vulnerability of like, you know, if an entity appears to you, you know, let's just say a daimon, like generally to use inclusive language, we'll call all of our entities daimons. It's 2024.
This is called men among demons. I appreciate you using it in this context.
Okay.
In this context is very appropriate, but we do not need to. We can hurt demons' feelings on this show. Like, but your actual point you're making.
Entities, right? Like, let's say an entity appears to you. You're already vulnerable, right? In the same way that, like, you know.
That's a very good point.
If it's midnight and you're at a bar somewhere and some guy comes up to you, like, you've presented yourself at midnight in a bar. Like, there's a vulnerability to that also. And I'm not saying that, like, don't want to say that, you know, if you present yourself at midnight in a bar, like, and something bad happens to you. There's some intentionality which has preceded the situation in which you find yourself.
I think it's worse than an expectation. You could be at a bar for other reasons. In this case,
yes,
you aren't. You're doing it for that reason. You're saying, I want to have an experience. I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah.
That's our purpose.
A bar in a certain neighborhood with right. a certain crowd that's known to be there and puffing up right. your chest and going yeah. and poking people and
yeah, you're that's actually, right.
You're kind of looking for a fight. Is what
some entity sidles up to you yeah. and is like, you know, you're like, "Are you my guardian angel?" And they're like, "Yeah, baby, I'll be whatever you want." Like.
Perfect. You're blowing. Exactly. You're shocking me with as you work this metaphor.
you know, it keeps
way too much.
Who is this entity? No, it's also a valid question, and like you know, I think, like it's something that we can't know. It's interesting to me that the standard hesychastic advice about having a mystical experience, encountering an entity, or seeing the uncreated light is. Just kind of ignore it, right? Like,
downplay it.
Like, yeah, you're not going to forget that
about it. Yeah,
right. But like, it's not a broadcasty kind of thing, right. And it's also
there was one time in my life, and it's a famous story, and it's out there on the internet where I, you know, prayerfully asked for a sign and actually got one that mm-hmm. resulted in me being an Orthodox Christian. Was quite a wild experience, and I can get why when people hear a story like that, they might think, "Well, I want to have an experience like that." But one of the things I was definitely prepared for in that moment, and in fact expecting, was that there just wouldn't be anything.
Right.
And you have to go, and my expectation, you know, praying for this sign at this crux point of my life was, you have to. These thoughts went through my head at that time. You have to be ready for the sign to be that nothing happens, right? You have to be ready for it to be like, well, you're not getting one. You've got to trust. And there've been other times I think I haven't been quite as explicit, but there's been many, many times in my life, and I'm sure every Christian's life, where I can prayerfully think, I could really use some clear guidance here, Lord, you know? And the vast majority of the time, other than that one case, when I felt it, like I felt like I wanted more sort of explicit guidance or something like that, nothing has happened. And I think for the Christian, you have to be prepared to say, then that's God's will.
Right.
Like, and then you need to deal with it. I mean, if you need to keep living with the tension, then you need to keep living with the tension. And there's something something that bothers me a lot about saying, no, I'm going to get it.
I'm going to make
you give me a sign by taking eating a mushroom or whatever. That just seems disordered to me. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that's the feel for me.
The concern I have there is that we run the risk of attempting to domesticate God, and God is wild.
Yeah.
And God will not just hop up on our lap like a lap dog when we say, come here. Right. And boy, does that feel painful sometimes.
Oh yeah, it does.
I mean, the flip side is he could turn you into an Ananias and Sapphira or an Nadab and Abihu. Like it can cost God's holiness has costed people their lives when they deal with it carelessly. We have stories in our scripture of exactly this.
Right. Yeah.
The ground has swallowed people whole.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you just don't want to. I mean, I know we don't think that these things really happen anymore, if they ever did. But like, I don't know, man. In our tradition, you just don't mess around. I keep thinking of Augustine, but you know, in the fourth, fifth centuries, this kind of pagan philosophical attempt to be post-Christian. Like theurgy, like this is, you know, to develop pagan philosophical liturgies that are oriented towards having an experience, and exactly this kind of thing, like a vision of the light. And this is, and it is just, and that's exactly what Augustine most directly associates that passage in Second Corinthians about Satan appearing as an angel of the light. Like as far as Augustine is concerned, that's what he's talking about. It's like these pagan rituals that are aimed at exactly what we're talking about, right? It's like trying to manufacture an experience of divinity as a way of sort of you know, cultivating blessedness in your life or whatever. And it's dicey.
I'm kind of like, I'm sympathetic to that in a pre-Christian context where Christ had not come in the flesh. There was no kind of, I say all these things as somebody who like very much understands the appeal of like, you know, after my friend had her experience on ayahuasca and all of this stuff, I was like, wow, that's cool. Boy, would I love to see the Theotokos and have her deliver a message to me. Like, that would be amazing, especially if it was a good message, right?
Well, and I think, and this came up in the last episode as well. It seems to me to be crucial as the church's response. If people have gone and done this, like, the wildness of God, we equally cannot just say that, well, that's by definition.
No, because we can't. Right?
It's the totality of God's wildness, and that yes, if someone has gone and dropped mushrooms and then they had this vision and like
you know, and what she said
it led them in this good direction, and now
they led her in a good direction.
And now they're here in church, and now they want to follow Christ and receive the sacrament. Like, I mean, I equally cannot be the one to be like, well, but you were on shrooms, so it's invalid either.
Absolutely not.
To make it as a conscious choice on purpose, you know, from from within the church or the tradition seems to be a little more problematic. Not that God, of course God could use a mushroom, but we can't make God use a mushroom. I can't you have to use the mushroom. That's the rule. It feels like that there's a piece of that that's happening certainly out in the secular world, even if they wouldn't have language for it, saying, I'm going to make the spiritual powers have to, do something for me or give me some experience. But equally, you've also talked a bit, Eleni, about people who it's just a flop, right? Who've done it.
Gabe Armonte or something.
Dozens and dozens of times. And there's just nothing.
Yeah. There's a author on Prama. He's a physician. His name is Gabor Mate. I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name, but
I'm not sure either. So don't
Dr. Mate. Let's say he is 80 years old and so grumpy and such a crusty barnacle. I just love him. And
Eleni really likes crusty barnacles. She's married to one, so.
Crusty barnacles with hearts of gold. That's my whole jam. But he's a fascinating character. So he, for the past like 20 years, has essentially been guiding these ayahuasca retreats, right? And so he would provide the sort of after counseling around people's spiritual experiences. And he describes for like 16 years... Ayahuasca is very fascinating to me because it has all of the things that I said at the outset we would need to have were we to do a psychedelic experience of some kind, right? So it has all of the parameters. There's lots of banishing happening. There's prayers. There's a fasting tradition. You have to do certain things for a certain number of days before you come. Like the priests come, they pray over, like all kinds of stuff, right? So it's heavily grounded in this ritual, which provides all of the kind of like the care and the protection that we would need to do all of these, you know, enter into this other realm. Anyway, so he basically attended these ceremonies for like 13 years, providing some of the after counseling to people who come out of them. His very, I can't remember when exactly this happened, but he was trying ayahuasca for a number of years. Nothing would happen. He would just become violently ill, which is something that happens as a result of DMT, the compound that's in it. It causes like a physical illness. So you actually feel quite, so there's like an ascetic element to it as well. And so nothing would happen to him. Finally, he went to one ceremony where, he comes to this ceremony and this group of people, and one of the priests from, I cannot remember which indigenous culture it is that this arises from, but essentially one of their priests or shaman kind of approaches him and says, "You can't be here. Something bad happened to you when you were very small, and you're not over it yet." At this point, he's 70 years old. His entire story is that when he was an infant, it was during the Holocaust, and he was in Hungary and was the child of Jewish parents. His grandparents were essentially sent to concentration camps and killed, and his mother had to give him up to a Christian woman who sheltered him while she went into hiding for 7 months. And then upon their reunion, he said it took many months until he would even look at his mother again, because he was so traumatized by what had happened as an infant. And he talks about this very widely throughout all of his stuff. I shared with Dan that, like, it's unclear whether the priests were clairvoyant or whether they just had a good look at him, because he has, like, the worst RBF of, like, any person I've ever seen. Like, he just looks so dissatisfied all the time. And, you know, like a crusty barnacle. And so
sometimes you can just put two and two together.
Yeah, they were like, you.
It's that they would not only notice, but care. Like, it points to what this tells me is that you're dealing with a culture there. And I don't know if we can endorse it or not endorse it. I would just claim agnosticism about that. But these are clearly traces of a culture that has experienced the danger of what they're doing.
Yes.
We create a bunch of boundaries. We're going to say to certain people, you are not in the state of mind. You can't
here.
You can't do this. This is going to go bad for you. I mean, you're talking about generations of experience that are all manifest in every one of those things to say, this isn't just drop shrooms, see God, life fixed, right?
And they also were like, you're going to ruin it for everyone else. So, like, what's going on with you, your spiritual state is going to infect the entire community unless we deal with what's going on with you. So he had to be peeled off. He had several days of fasting. A priest would come and read prayers over him for 3 hours at a time every single day. And, like, after that, he finally came back and he started participating in these ceremonies. But for, I think, 13 or 14 years, absolutely nothing happened. He would just become violently ill. And then nothing. Right. So he was waiting and waiting and waiting for all these spiritual experiences to happen, but nothing. He got to counsel everyone else through their experiences. I think finally at the age of, like, in some point in his 70s, don't quote me on the exact timelines of this because this is all sort of maybe mixed up in my mind. But he finally had a vision of the word for happiness or joy written in Hungarian across the sky. And that was his whole vision. And he said it filled him with a sense of peace. And, like, that was that. But it was that, like, I don't know that he would describe that as, like, the summation of, like, was that a piece of the puzzle for him? Absolutely. Right? Was that necessarily, like, you know, I don't know if that was the whole thing for him. But, yeah, all of that to say I'm extremely sympathetic to people who say that that has been an important part of their experience. And certainly we should create some space for processing those things, you know, being able to have conversations about that, what that meant. And I also hold on the other hand that, like, were we to say that that would be a necessary or required thing to recommend or suggest, I worry that we would be saying that the mysteries themselves were insufficient in some way. Right?
Well, and so, what if it's the opposite? I mean, what if the nothing is just as important? I'm thinking of Saint Soul on the Athenite story, which is
absolutely
this, you know, everything kicks off with this profound vision, and then the whole point of the story is that him struggling through that, the loss of that, and basically living a pretty much regular monk, a monastic, but a regular life without fireworks ever again.
Yeah, doesn't he like fight for like a decade or more to try to have another vision or something like that?
Yeah, he does. He's trying.
And all it does is like he just keeps battling with demons. Crazy. Like,
right. Yeah. And he only comes to peace and achieves holiness. So the narrative goes. But you know, this is a fairly recent saint, right? We're talking 19th century, and his spiritual disciple who wrote his great the great biography about him is now also a canonized saint. Really interesting thinker. But like the kind of the point of the narrative is that he arrives at peace when he realizes, oh, the fireworks were not the point. And it's almost a torture for him to have had that experience. Even though it's never, at least in that narrative, it's never cast as though it was a false experience all along or something.
Right.
That's how the story ends. It was understood by him, people around him and so forth, as an absolutely genuine experience. But the point, the deeper wisdom he comes to realize is the experience wasn't the point. And what I think just sort of troubles me in this culture is that notion of, is that notion of like the experience is a good thing. I feel like we need to be able to affirm that there's nothing lost for a Christian who has never had any kind of a mystical experience at all.
Right.
There's nothing lost for an Orthodox Christian because,
the real
entheogen is in that chalice. Like
some of us are screwed otherwise.
Well, right.
Yeah.
A lot of people say we don't.
Okay. I also think we have to be very, very careful about cordoning off mysticism to seeing a vision. Because
that's a great point to start in our second half. We take a quick break here because mysticism, mental health, and what visions have to do with that, I think would be a really, really interesting direction to go in. If you're game.
I'm game.
Well, let's take a quick break and we'll come back and talk about those things.
Your support makes this podcast possible. Find us on Patreon at patreon.com/menamongdemons for exclusive content and to join the conversation.
Welcome to the Men Among Demons podcast.
And there goes the devil, creeping in my life's desire.
Okay, so welcome to the second half. So we left it there on the topic of mystical experiences and spirituality and maybe mental health as well. And what these things have to do with any of that. I mean, what do you think there, Eleni? You said some interesting things in the last few weeks about this to me. I don't know if they'll get repeated here, but...
I don't know either.
I don't have a memory necessarily what they were, just that they were very, very...
I just want everyone to know that the conversations we have had in the past few weeks have been like 500 times better than this podcast episode, just so everyone knows.
So turn the podcast off
and just, should have been recording.
Just move in with Dan and Eleni. That's the lesson here.
What does this have to do with us being healthy? You know, mentally, like what is the role of any of this in our picture as Orthodox Christians of a mentally, spiritually, you know, just generally healthy, integrated person? Like what role does this even play anyway?
It's weird for me because, and I hope that none of my clients or colleagues hear this and misunderstand what I'm about to say, but the term mental health to me just feels very, feels problematic in and of itself. Mm-hmm. I think health or wholeness is a more helpful starting point to look at in terms of what we're aiming for when we're looking at healing, when we're looking at kind of restoration of the image of God. The term mental health already indicates fragmentation because we're taking sort of the mental part of the being, the non-physical part of the being, and saying that, you know, this is a separate part from, like, you know, your physical body. And I can tell you right now, like, boy, that is not true. Like, the clients that I work with fibromyalgia, with unexplained chronic pain, with forms of like rheumatoid arthritis, with autoimmune disorders, with PCOS, like all of these kinds of things.
For me, it was just good old back pain, but still.
Good old back pain, right? Yeah. Like, the number of clients with some of those physical ailments which don't show up on screens and for whom the only solution is opioids, who do not have trauma in their childhood, is, I don't know if I've ever worked with someone who doesn't have trauma in their childhood who has one of those conditions. And so thinking about health as a holistic category involving the body, the mind, you know, and I mean, body, spirit, and soul, it's difficult for me because I don't work within a religious context. So I am thinking of that, even though I'm working with, you know, clients who may or may not have any spirituality, but I don't like to play into the fragmentation of mind and body. And for me, the healing of trauma is sort of like integration, right? Fragmentation is always like, you know, division is kind of the mark of diabolos, right? Like the divider, yeah. Right? So there's a natural kind of fragmentation that happens with any woundedness as a result of contact with the fallen world, which trauma it certainly is. It's kind of like, I might be going off on a tangent on this. I can't remember your initial question, but the phrase mental health, I think, already creates some problematic difficulties around, like, problematic ideas around how we interact with something like a particular diagnosis or a traumatic event, because it's sort of assuming that, you know, there's sort of this part of you that has feelings and thoughts, and there's your body. We know for a fact that's not the way that trauma especially acts. It's a very somatic felt sense, which is in your body. And so part of what's important is restoring a felt sense of safety, and relieving some of the bodily distress using the relationship, right, as a healing technology, essentially.
Yeah, like, I think that ties in well with what we were talking about in the first half in terms of, well, especially distinguishing between, let's say, making a crude distinction between sort of the kind of culture that's developing now of like spiritual psychedelic induced spiritual insight versus the long traditional practice of ayahuasca or whatever, right? Like that,
right?
Yeah, the difference between a tradition embedded practice of these kinds and the desire for a mystical experience, which does seem sort of intrinsically, I don't know if disembodied, but like disconnected, right? Disconnected, mm-hmm. Like I'm going to eat something and then have a mystical experience, and not as a part of that, like that the desires for the kind of the directness of it, right? The directness of the mystical experience, not for the ritual embeddedness of it, not for the disciplines of thought and imagination that need to go along with it, not for the connection to community and the fellowship that need to go along with it, but just I'm gonna take the thing, like almost a medicalization of it, right? That's which is kind of what we're dancing around as well.
Yeah, well, that's what I was just gonna say. Yeah, it reminds me a lot of what we're doing in a lot of spheres of life,
yeah.
And that
it's all separating.
It's like the religious version of what we're often doing with, you know, mental health, which all because I was gonna say there, Eleni, like. We also see, I think, a lot in our culture, a move to disintegrate by basically effectively claiming that we're just bodies, right? So that while depression is merely a
another disintegration, yeah.
Right. So now you're saying, well, now my mental, now my thoughts and my memories and my experiences have nothing to do with this. It's just that my serotonin system's messed up. So I take the pill, I'm fixed, right? Yeah. The way that, you know, if I have a physical infection, you know, bacterial infection, I take an antibiotic and, you know, it will clear up. It kind of, no matter what my state of mind is, it'll work, right? Because it works on the physical level. That's what it does. Yeah. But we often see mental health. It feels like we're a very schizophrenic society. And of course it depends on who you ask, but like these disintegrating moves all seem interconnected to me. And they're all related to this like consumerist desire to take the thing, get result, right?
Get your result.
Just fundamentally like individualist, right? Which is another expression of its disassociativeness. Right. Yeah. Is that I don't want to have to do this through entering into a tradition, entering into a practice, entering into a community. But like I can by myself make a decision on if you could just give me the thing, then I can do it. And that's like obviously that's going to be an oversimplification of maybe lots of people's experience. But there's that that further fragmentation and individuation. That is just a little suspicious, right? It's just a bit suspicious.
Well, we want it quick. We want it. And this does connect to the first half. Like we want to be able to force it. And it seems to me that something like mental health and spiritual health and bodily health too, all three of these things. So the complete health of the human being is never really forcible either. But a key aspect of total human health is ultimately patience. Like, because there are things that will never be perfect, right? There are things that in this fallen world are never going to be quite right. And one of the most important things that a human being can realize to become a genuinely healthy human being is the space of acceptance when there just needs to be acceptance. Right. It's something that our society doesn't seem that comfortable with. And like, in pain relievers, you brought up opioids, Eleni. Potentially, I'm not saying no one should ever take, pain medications, opioids, or otherwise.
Opioids
I take Advil when I get the migraines. Yeah, but it's like there's also a space at which there are certain kinds of things that are the way they are that can't be fixed, and that sometimes kicking against the goads, like just makes things worse. In my own process to try to become a mentally healthier person. To use that term for a second, even though we've already problematized it. This was an enormously huge turn. I was like, well, yeah, like sometimes, I'm not really perfect. I'm not going to be happy all the time. Is that what I think some part of me thought we got this idea that that's what I guess normal people, and I'm actually vastly healthier when I can get up and have a day where I just feel crappy or sad or frustrated because something happened or this or, and then it's just like, yeah, well, whatever. I can be depressed for a day now. And that didn't really used to be true because I had so over problematized being depressed for a day. Being depressed for a day is like, welcome to life on earth. You will have days where you feel depressed. Yeah. I got news. Yeah. And there's no pill and there's no process. There's nothing that will make that go away in this fall in life.
Yeah.
And so the actual acceptance of it is huge. It's hugely important for that integration. It seems to me. But this is a culture that just wants to fix. And as you're saying, Eleni, that's a disintegrative impulse, I think.
Yeah. I think where I've kind of landed on this personally, professionally, is that also there has to be some room to see illness in general as a process being unfolded versus a problem which needs an end and a solution immediately. Yeah. And, I acknowledge, especially with my clients, like how painful that is. But when we sort of open ourselves up to that view of seeing it as an organic unfolding process, then I think we can, there's some space to actually use whatever pain we're experiencing, either physically or mentally, as a teacher, as a guide, as perhaps an illuminator of some parts of ourselves, some wounds that are incredibly important and require attention, versus requiring stifling or being cut off or being dismissed or suppressed in some way. The vast majority of the time, especially with like my chronic pain clients, mm-hmm. There are particular like ways that pain will show up. And there's, you know, sometimes interpersonal situations that will flare up chronic pain. They have a really bad chronic pain day, right? And it's like, well, I had this fight with whoever, like, you know, or something happened, or I drove by the hospital and I thought of this or that. And it's like,
that's striking. Isn't that striking? That's just
it
wild.
Is uncanny to me. Yeah, and, true, though. Not something that I really expected, I think, like 5 years ago, probably.
Right. It's just never disconnected or whatever.
I mean, I go back to fibromyalgia because the connection there to trauma is so, so salient in the research. Like, I have yet to have a client with fibromyalgia who hasn't had childhood trauma, right? But there are ways in which, like, the appearance of pain can act as sort of like an indicator light, right? Like, something has happened that has led me to suppress a need or to be pulled in a particular direction that's unhealthy. And, you know, if we see that as sort of a process unfolding when we are maybe neglecting some part of our experience that we need to bring attention to, then we can start to have a much more compassionate view of our own pain and our own illness than when we see it as like, okay, well, I have this problem and like, I have to, you know, stifle this somehow or bring it to an end somehow in the most expedient way. That's not to, you know, say that medication is like, you know, a stifling of those emotions necessarily. But anytime we come to any aspect of any sort of technology that we use for healing, including therapy, right? With sort of this vision of like, okay, I need to fix this problem. We're going to like wrap it up. I'm done suffering now. Like, I've had enough of this, you know, we're going to get stuck. Right. Mm-hmm. Unless we sort of befriend all of the elements of that as an organic process. But sorry.
Yeah, what I was going to jump in there is like I'm pretty sure that like these things also are real. And that's actually the point. Like, right. I feel like there's been a sort of tradition to some degree in Western medicine is saying, well, if it's in your mind, then it's not really in your body. So fibromyalgia is like all in your head. It's not all in your head. You are feeling that's real, right?
Absolutely.
Like, and I guess my minor example is the back pain. This is absolutely mental etiology, but my back was messed up. What's weird is that we think of that, we've arrived somehow in a culture that is skeptical of that or thinks of that as a weird thing to say. That's what's weird.
Yes, it's so weird.
It's bonkers because... If someone scares me, if someone jumps out of the shadows at me, my body reacts to this experience. I have mental fear and my body responds to, you know, of course it's all integrated. Obviously it's all integrated. So of course, if something is true, you're on your way to, you're driving past, you know, your abusive ex's house and like, you know. Like how is that surprising to us? What have we, have we gotten here where this is like, you know, under a microscope as though that can't be true. You know, there's no relationship between your back pain or your fibromyalgia and like, you know, the trauma trigger. Like, of course there is. Hmm. Obviously
the
there
enlightenment.
Is.
I don't know. That's the only thing.
Yeah. Something like that. There's that disintegrative force to see that, you know.
Yeah. It is like the whole thing. Yeah, the separation of material stuff from sort of these non-material things, which are always connected in some way. Yeah, and it's you can see all of the problems that creates, particularly for people who have these, who have problems and pain that don't show up on, you know, scans of any kind, right? But nonetheless are debilitating and constant force in their day.
It feels to me like one of the other issues here too is a kind of overgeneralization. I think this even connects into that first half piece with the psychedelics and the ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. The sense that, you know, because a certain strategy worked over here, you know, it'll work over there. So so the antibiotics have done just shocking. And I mean, unless you've studied much what life was like before antibiotics, it's hard for our moderns to even comprehend. You know, you could go be pruning your roses, get a little cut and you die. Like that could be that's how people would die like that. Roses specifically, because they have a particular, there's something about roses where there's a bacterium often on there. Roses used to be dangerous. I don't mean like, ooh, I got hurt. Like that's what a rose is in my life. Roses could kill you. And we don't live in that world anymore.
Freaking crazy. Yeah.
We can't even really wrap our minds around it. But there's a sense of overgeneralization that, okay, so someone came up with a wonder drug for bacterial infections. Someone came up with these series of wonder drugs, these vaccines for a lot of viral infections as well. And those are amazing. And it's like this incredible miracle. And we see it and we go, okay, there's got to be some way to do that for depression. It's got to be some way to do that for anxiety.
Right.
That doesn't follow. Or even, it doesn't make
or
sense.
Or even other viruses and all other viruses.
Right. It doesn't even necessarily work for literally all
that's
all
right.
Viruses.
Yeah. No, that's
true. And the psychedelics, it feels to me, is like, it just looks to me like it's the same kind of thing. Like, oh, yeah, well, there's got to be a pill for my spiritual problems too, right? Because there are these miracle pills that are real. It's not that they're fake. They are real. That's exactly the thing. And there's this human tendency to say, oh, well, that's how we should do everything. Or we cut it the other way and we say, oh, you know, the body isn't anything. I'm just, you know, it's all the mind. And right. But your body is part of that as well. If you don't care for the body, like exercise is very, very good for depression and anxiety. That
absolutely
really helps. You know, just taking basic care of your physical body will help you.
Yeah.
And so it's not just in your head or something. Like it's always everything.
Right.
And it's always a mystery. It's always a profound mystery to work your way towards being a healthy person. And it's always a process and it's never finished.
Yeah,
no one has the cure.
I thought you were going to go in a different place with that comment about like assuming that if something works in one place, it'll, you know, if it works over here, it'll work over there. But, to get back around there, like part of, I think what's happening here is that, right, the idea that psychedelics can play the role for our mind, what these other kinds of medications can play for our body. And that's not quite how it works. That's already a fragmented, problematic way of looking at things. But nevertheless, these kinds of drugs do have that power. So one, it's kind of a category confusion. That it's not just like that psychedelics aren't just like antibiotics or whatever kind of shot boost that you'd get in your body, like a steroid or something for your mind.
Yeah.
Right. It's a different kind of thing because the mind is a different kind of thing. But also like that like where I thought you were going to go was like, well, just because ayahuasca works in this setting, in this part of the country, in this part of the continent, among this people with this tradition, doesn't mean you can just like transplant it. Because that, and which gets back around to kind of one of the questions I'd like us to talk about before we're done, which is like,
yeah,
you know, this question
ayahuasca tourism.
Or the adoption of psychedelics in like this question of about orthodoxy, like just because you discover something that works a certain way that's interesting and some people find compelling over here, mm-hmm. does that mean we bring it into this tradition that already has its integrity? And there's something about this, like just right. because something works over there doesn't mean it works over here.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Right. Like, are things like that transplantable? Are psychedelics the kinds of things that are transplantable into different liturgies? And is the specifically Orthodox liturgical life the kind of thing that just anything can be transplanted into? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. The answer is
answered no right away.
I mean, I think the answer is no.
But like, so I think it is actually connected in my mind to ayahuasca tourism, which I'm very skeptical about because it's you can't just fly in. You can't just drop like.
Father Jeffrey alluded to also like the damage that's done to those communities as a result of that too.
Which makes perfect sense.
You can imagine what starts to happen when a bunch of rich white people show up and are just like, hey, we want to do your ceremony too. And it's like, okay. You know, and what kind of
reputation does that create? Yeah, I mean, imagine if that happened at our church that, like,
like, can you imagine if a church down the street was offering it and we weren't? And then, like, how do we interact with our other
ayahuasca. I mean, what we do. Like, if people came in and did it, but they wanted to do it, like, they wanted to pay us and, like, go through it once.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, and maybe that first person.
Simony.
We wouldn't do it even for the first person. But I could see in those contexts, like if it's literally one person, you might go, hey, this person's interested, they're curious, right? And it like if someone comes from whatever background and says, I want to like really do this, like I want to convert and make this my life, then of course I'm always welcome. But I'm saying if people started coming to Orthodox churches as bona fide tourists, I'm gonna be here for a week. You do the magic stuff. I pay you, I leave.
Yeah.
I'd be like, what? And if that started to be like, this is 80, this is 90%, this is 99% of people who are there on a Sunday, it's like, whoa, what? What's even happening here anymore? We're just a service industry now?
Right.
People from somewhere else who got on a plane to like watch us do our magic or.
Well,
or,
and in a certain sense, like
the sacrament.
You know, the experience of if it's not quite the participation in the sacraments, but you know that there are these sort of big, iconic tourist churches like cathedrals and things and like what
it would be, a problem.
And if you've ever ever visited one, like I haven't visited a lot, but I just remember even visiting kind of the main cathedral in Helsinki, which is quite a beautiful cathedral, and it's like, and there's a bunch of tourists there, and like what would it be like? And I was Orthodox, like this is only a few years ago, and like looking at the Orthodox people there worshiping and
just
like,
trying to have
service, and it's right. like
what? How annoying would that be
for your liturgical community to be like a tourist trap,
right?
It's like that doesn't not affect the quality of community and the quality. So I can
that's the one way, but I think it's closely related to it's a bi-directional thing. So the dropping in as a tourist and trying to like do that tradition, something I'm profoundly skeptical of, because this is enculturated. This is happening with a specific group of people who have a community. And so, you know, maybe it's a little better than just like dropping shrooms wherever the hell you are, because there are certain boundaries, but you're still not going to be inhabiting the entire process.
No.
Right. Like, because the entire process is a whole life. Part of the process is, you know, visiting your grandma because you live there and these are the people you know. And like,
she collects the herbs that are used in the ceremony.
Right. And it's
uncle,
a life.
He does the prayers.
And even all that doesn't necessarily justify it from an Orthodox Christian point of view, because this whole thing could be off the rails. but even if we just give it the most generous read we possibly can, like you can't really just drop in as a tourist and do that any more than you could in the Orthodox life. But then the reverse, it seems to me, is also It seems to me true as well. You can't just willy-nilly. It's not that we can never adapt to anything, but we also can't just grab whatever just because it seems to be working.
I mean,
South
yeah.
America, as you're saying, right, Greg, and, right. and say, well, now yeah. let's do that too, because this is we're talking about millennia of yes. absorption.
Like, think of how yeah. far back wine goes in our tradition.
Yes,
like it in yes. the text, it goes back to
exactly.
Noah. It goes yeah. back to the prehistory of like prehistory.
Right.
It's yeah. so ancient. It's ancient history to people who are ancient history to people who are ancient history to people who are ancient history to us. Like, that is how long back that is. That's how far back Noah is. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's, you know, that's how deep wine, that's how far back wine goes for us.
Right.
So like
right.
to have these other, because we talk about this, but right. Wow. We use alcohol. We use this other psychoactive substance.
We use it with boundaries in place.
Right.
Also for the Eucharist, we use an absolutely minuscule amount of it. I mean,
the boundary is the amount.
Yep. That's part of it.
The boundary is the amount and also the use of water, right? Like there's specific boundaries in place around that.
And those boundaries come from, and well, the dilution of water has, you know, specific theological textual reference and traditions that have been around, and the boundaries come both from the mythology of it, like where does this come from, mm-hmm. and why do we use it, but also just that that experience of its risk, and that experience over millennia of its riskiness, and how you, because the riskiness of it is exactly to the point of it. I mean, that's kind of the point of the story of the drunkenness of Noah.
Yes. Yes,
like you're trying. Is Noah using wine to try to solve the problem of the fall? I mean, which is what we use alcohol for.
it would not surprise me if there were early Christian communities who were overdoing it. I mean, honestly, and like the Lord's Supper, and the guy started getting drunk, and over time you start to go.
It seems to be one of the
need the symbol of it, because really in Orthodox practice it's
pretty
so
close to implied, and it's pretty close implication in First Corinthians, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Feasting.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you can't eat at home. Like, this isn't a pagan. Right. You know, we're not getting drunk here.
Yeah. You're
well. Yeah. For the Greeks, it's like, you know, you're coming right out of that pagan tradition of like, yeah, we are getting really drunk right now.
We're getting drunk and having
that's
sex
the
with everyone.
Point
is what worship
is. Like, yeah. And then you see how over time, like as things shift, there's kind of like. Yeah, I'm interested. I don't know. I'm interested also in like, what is it about Christianity that creates some of these boundaries? And like, mm-hmm. I'm not sure I can articulate that, right? Like, it's not merely the passage of time, because obviously some of those pagan rituals were around for like a really long time. Right, but there's something about like
Paul knew right away. He's like, that's not what we're gonna do here. This is not how we're gonna do it. We're not gonna
abide in
drunkenness. Yeah,
the incarnation of Christ, the Logos, that makes that no longer necessary.
Christianity has a very substantive distrust for the irrational and for the out of control. It's something that people critique us for to this day, and they always have. I mean, it's something that Nietzsche just takes us to town on. Like, you all don't know how to have a good old bacchanalia or whatever and just really go crazy. And that's why you're repressed, and that's why you're a mess. Like, this is you know, one of Nietzsche's many critiques, but it's a key Nietzschean critique, and it's been a critique since ancient times. Like, you all need to know how to have an orgy. Like, you can't be real. You can't be complete people without full blown orgies, right? And the Christian tradition is in the Orthodox Christian tradition, feasting is still taken very seriously, but it's
a, well, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
It's not an orgy. Feast is not an orgy, right? And that's what Paul is talking about.
Okay.
Feast, you can have your supper, but you're not having orgies. And so this is something that Christians, this is something that comes with Christianity historically, as far as I can see, at least in the West. And people have always mocked us for it, and they always will, but it's kind of part and parcel of a sort of what we do and sort of what we are. I don't know how, I mean, what exactly the why is, I don't know, but there've always been Christian groups who've come along and challenged that and pressed that. And the church's immune system, you might say, historically has been to say, we've ground you. We have to stay rational. We have to stay on our feet.
Well, perhaps,
and this is one of my concerns about some of these sorts of things about, psychedelics and so forth, is that it seems to push to me maybe a bit too far on that, and we lose that sense of, you know, balance and rationality. And like you were saying earlier too, Eleni, like that the monastic processing of mystical experiences is often very, very, very often ignore it, right? Like, well, when in doubt, just pay no attention, right? Because most important, first and foremost, we keep our heads on our shoulders, keep steady, we keep sober, literally and figuratively, sober minded. And that's just really important. And people can throw rocks at us all they want, but the older I get, the more wisdom I see in that person.
I mean, perhaps it all just goes back to like good fences make good neighbors. And in a pre-Christian world, you wouldn't need any fences, because what would you be fencing in? You know, like what would be the...
Right. it's a different way of being. And I think this is sort of what I'm trying to get at, is it's not... There are other ways to go be human, and sure, they're out there, but, I think we have to be bold enough to say, yeah, we do value sober-mindedness. We do. I don't want, that's what I mean. People have always mocked us for it. They mock us for it today. And I think we have to have the courage to be like, yeah, well, okay, mock away, but yeah, we do value that.
Yeah.
We don't do orgies. We don't just lose our minds and go crazy. We don't drop shit tons of
ass from limb.
We don't just get
living
drunk
as living like as children of the day. Protection. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that we don't. That's how. And yeah, take it or leave it in our culture. But that's how we do. And suck it, Nietzsche. Like whatever. Okay. You think we're also oppressed? I mean, I don't know. Did Nietzsche's how does Nietzsche's life look to you compared to the saints? You know, ask yourself that.
I know. I mean, the thing is that the culture that he's like since we're sort of dwelling in first century Christianity, you know, in pagan settings, it's like, yeah, those pagan settings were really indulgent in a lot of ways, and that somehow was matched to like a deep exploitativeness and hierarchical stratification it's a pretty good gig if you can get it at the top, but for the rest of you, man, do you get screwed.
These people killed people for fun.
It's awful.
Their sports was killing people. Yeah.
Right.
It's like those all go together. Like all that, all the, you know, orgiastic sexual promiscuity, feasting, gorging, like on food, all that indulging and acquiescence to the passions just seem to be matched with just ruthlessness and treating other people as objects and means for your own self-gratification.
Nietzsche keeps coming into my mind because it's related to me. It's connected in my mind to what we're talking about with disintegration. Like I think the Nietzschean paradigm, and I think he gets it right. You know, we're talking Twilight of the Idols, beginning, like early Nietzsche, before he's gone totally ultra atheist, but he'll get there. He gets, and I think he accurately gets, that the game that's being played for for humans in these pagan cultures is you have, you know, you have this kind of period of sober minded, and then you have just like orgiastic, like you just kind of let all the energy out, and that the rhythm of the society is to do this in these patterns and these periods and in these different ways. And he looks at that as a real positive. But you know, as you're like, it's actually a disintegrative thing. It's to say that, yes, I am indeed kind of two people at least, right, maybe many more. I am at least a version of me that is sober-minded and steady and rational and can make rational decisions. But there's also this other me that is just completely an animal, out of control, and that the way to deal with the animal, and Nietzsche pretty much explicitly says this, the way to deal with the animal is you let it out sometimes and you let it go crazy sometimes.
Right.
And I think the Christian tradition wants to say, no, what you do is you integrate in Christ, and Christ overcomes all of the problems of the animal without you ceasing to be an embodied,
right,
like taxonomically we're all animals, we're mammals, right? Like that doesn't cease to be true in Christ, but in Christ is this vision of true integration, which actually plays pretty nicely with Carl Jung's thought, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I think Nietzsche's actually right about what's happening in those pagan rituals, and the Christians are coming along and in a pretty bold way saying, we see what you're doing, and no, we want something more, we want something beyond, we want something to me is far greater and far more beautiful, which is to be a whole integrated self and to be that all the time, frankly, and not have to go through periods where I am just a wild, wild animal because the energy has built up.
Mr. Hyde.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I think what comes up for me as you talk too, Dan, is that like good religion, you know, including within the church, integrates kind of mysticism and the mystical experience with asceticism, and those two things go really closely together.
Right.
And so they always, you know, and it's not like in a very formulaic Pelagian kind of way, like I do the Jesus prayer this many times and like the prayer of the heart 10,000 times and then I have this mystical experience, but there's an assumption that those things are going to be going together. And so there's a kind of purification of the will, or really a cultivation of the will,
mm-hmm,
that comes in conjunction with some of these ecstatic experiences, right? Because like when you're talking about like, hey, let's just do whatever the hell we feel like and everybody have like group sex and we're going to get totally smashed, like that's actually an enactment of a lack of will. A lack of free will.
Right.
Right? Like, you know, if you were to, you know, if we can be a bit fanciful, if you were to like beam into the consciousness of an asteroid falling to Earth, it would be like, I am completely free. Like, all I want to do is fall. Right? But you would look at it and be like, oh, there's all of these other forces acting on you. Like, did you know that? Like, there's like gravity. There's all these things that are actually impacting you right now. I don't know, like, if you actually were aware of that, right? And so, like, in asceticism and in creating some of these boundaries and, like, being able to, just in the ascetic experience, we actually cultivate a will alongside which kind of creates like, you know, a bit of a landing pad for a mystical experience should it be available. That feels really significant to me that those two things go together. I'm not sure if I can articulate why. Maybe you guys can articulate what I'm trying to say.
Well, I think you just said like it's the integrative, this is all one. Yeah, it's not Jekyll and Hyde, right? It's got to be
right.
Cared for.
Well, and it's like the idea of like having like the will as being something that you need to cultivate in order for it to be what it is.
Yes,
right? The will for that you need to cultivate in order for it to be properly free.
That's
right.
Actual
that an freedom, underformed right. will, the will that we kind of have at base level that's just beholden to its desires. An underformed will is just seeking, it's just always satisfying its desires, but that's
then it's a slave to its desires. Mm-hmm. And to sort of bring it around full circle like that, right? That there is, where, you know, what's the relation between the will, willingness, and the desire to have this mystical experience? Right, like where is the cultivation? You know, where is the cultivation of the will, or is it an attempt to have the will over precisely overpowered, or something like that? Right, like what's the idea of wanting to have this experience that can do the thing for you?
Right. Yeah.
Bypasses your will, right? To bypass the will without having to cultivate it, without having to do the work of cultivating it, and
which is asceticism. Yeah, I guess that is my fear, my concern about some of this desire for mystical experience, and like, you know, the reason I haven't done ayahuasca is that in myself, I just see that desire for a shortcut,
right?
And just to be like, exactly. Yeah. But that's what it would mean for me. And I'm not saying that would mean that for every single person, but like, it's just like, yeah, I don't really want to do asceticism. It's boring. Like, it's
there's that desire
to have kind of a shortcut of that experience. And then,
or I don't even know. I mean, shortcut maybe in some cases, but like what, something you said at the very beginning of part one, is that people are, you talk about working with the religious nuns, not the NUNs, the NONEs. Yeah, yeah. And a lot of what it feels like to me I'm watching is people who like just don't know where to go.
Right.
And those people, I have a lot of sympathy for.
Right.
Like,
absolutely. You want
to connect to a tradition. 100%. You want to connect to something that connects you to God, and you have no clue. Like neither you, and nowadays, like not even your parents had any religious or like anything. You're just, you're a pure secular, born to a pure secular, and you're starting to, you want to, and like, and whatever, like the next thing you read on the internet is what you're going to go try. And it's not always ayahuasca. It's any number of things. Right. It's
right.
And absolutely. Occasionally it's Orthodox Christianity, and they walk in the door, right? Yeah. And then we say hooray.
But
people are looking for stuff and thrashing around. Yeah. And like I could easily put myself in those shoes with no bearings, with no anything, no signposts at all in my life. And you know, some friend had this vision on ayahuasca, and I go, well, geez, maybe that's what I need. And there's nobody there to say, you know, my son, we can't speak to that person's experience, and I neither diminish nor endorse it, and that is what it is, and whatever. But you know, absolutely, what, my son, the greater wisdom is to know that you don't need to have that experience. The greater wisdom is to simply come in prayer and humility or whatever. And there's no one in your life to tell you anything other. So you just go do it. You give it a shot. Like, can't blame you. Can't judge. But like,
and maybe
because you're so disconnected, you have no tradition at all. You don't even have the South American tradition. You have no tradition. You have nothing.
Right.
It's just you. At like at a supermarket aisle of experiences, and no one has even told you what any of these products are.
Right.
And you're like, I don't, dragon fruit. I heard, or that one's good. Lucky charm. It's like buy a dragon. What should I buy? They don't even have anything to do with each other. But I don't know what anything is.
Yeah.
And here you go.
Right.
Okay, I'm gonna try out. I guess I'll grab the ayahuasca.
Right. Yeah.
But I need something. I got to put something in me. I've got to nourish me in some way.
A healthy response, even just to acknowledge that you have spiritual needs. That's
true. Yeah.
That's a healthy response. And I think like there are definitely situations where it's like, that was the most healthy spiritual response at the time, given paucity of options with which you were presented.
The most or the least, or it was something.
It was something.
What are we expecting these people to do? I mean, just out there floating, like,
it's fascinating. Well, that desire doesn't go away. And as we sort of see, you know, I guess I don't want to overstate this, but sort of the end of Christianity as a social as a societal norm or like entity in and of itself, as that kind of like empties or pours out into the greater society, we sort of see people continuing to have this need for sacramentality and mystery and some of these things, but with no kind of readily available way to meet it, right? And I would just hate to have capitalism be the thing that takes right. advantage of that.
Right. Right.
Which
is what it feels like. Which is what
which is what's happening.
Fundamentally, what it feels like, and what yeah. and what brings those feelings of like anxiety or like just like this dread about this current moment. It's like,
yeah,
that's what
yeah.
it feels like. Is that there's a real religious paucity and a real desire for spiritual things rightly mm-hmm. in mm-hmm. in people, and it's like capitalism's like, I got the next thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, like, we can sell it to you in this experience or this product or
whatever. Gods, they always are always getting in there.
Say more about that, Greg. The gods are getting in there.
Well, don't you think? I mean, like that, like capitalism has its own ordering spirits, and it's exactly the kind of thing
yeah.
that it does, swoops in to fill a need that it itself has created, right? And mm-hmm. and the way it meets that need will only generate further self alienation and fragmentation, which is what the demons do, right? It's yeah. principles of division and self-service, pride, fragmentation, right? Radical plurality. I don't know, man.
Yeah.
It just is of a pattern. It's of a pattern, and it's a demonic pattern. There, I said it. Not a daimonic pattern, Eleni. A demonic yeah. pattern.
Use inclusive language, Greg. All of our non-corporeal entities.
No.
Perfect.
It is. Yeah, it really is true. And it's, yeah, I think it's a powerful observation. I'm just thinking here about how wildly, wildly bold the Christian claim to integration really is.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, just it's a hell of a claim.
It's not easily shortcutted. It's not easily bought and sold.
Yeah. Oh, it sells very badly. It's a
That's
very hard
thing. Yeah. It's unpopular for that reason, right?
Process oriented.
Process yeah, orientation yeah. of asceticism.
No guarantees of huge mystical insight or heaven's opening, and I know, which is what we all want to pick up that theme again. It's like, yeah, we all want the heavens to open the moment that you approach the chalice for the first time, or that you enter the water as confirmation that you're doing the right thing. But for vast majority,
why do you either of you think that? Because one of the questions that raises to me as we sort of draw to a close, I guess, but it is, I kind of wonder why that happens at all. Because we do have that stuff in the tradition. Yeah. And I feel like the older I get and the longer I go at it, the more I think that, well, yeah, the more I apprehend how that's a sign that you're in the valley, not that you're on the peak.
Hmm.
That you have these profound experiences are a sign of, when you're really, really a healthy human from a Christian point of view, you don't need to have visions of Jesus standing in front of you, pouring out light. You just don't need that. Why would you need that? He is there every Sunday or every day or whatever, every Sunday in the chalice. He is there every single time you see a panhandler. He is right in front. You are looking straight into his eyes when you give a guy $5 on the street. Right.
I mean, you know that. Right. You know that.
The more you know that, the less you need these visions. The vision is the valley, right? So why do we have it at all?
You know that because you've stuck with the tradition this long to just really embed that awareness more. You know, more and more with you, right? But like I think that is the answer to it. You're giving the answer to your own question. Sometimes you're in a valley, and you really do need God to reach down and pluck you out.
Right.
And the thing is that sometimes like God plucking you out of a valley means that down the stream, you can help pluck me out of the valley. And that's, so it's not a great sky opening vision for me. But if I can have the humility to realize that like my lot in life is whatever God chooses it to be. And if I don't, If a heavenly locution or the sky is opening and a beam of light isn't what God has in store for me, that's fine. God gave me what I need in order to get me from where I was and onto the path. And that was through you and through other friends, you know, some of whom have, right? Like you have had certain experiences that were really profoundly mystical. And of course, we always point to the saints as well. It's like, and scriptures are full of these stories, really in a condensed way. And so it just, it radiates out and it winds, like it should find its way to, you know, for some of us, it's enough that other people have had those experiences and that's good. And for others of us, it's enough that you had it once, right? That was the thing that you needed at the moment to get your foot on the path. And then it's the question of, do you have the humility to take the, you know, just walk the path, right?
Right.
Like Saint Silouan, without ever having it again.
Yeah. I just come back to like the radical wildness of God, right? Where we don't, there's not a formula to either make that happen or not happen. And to the extent that we sort of try to create one or discover one, we're always going to fail. And part of our humility is also acknowledging, you know, cultivating our own freedom to the extent that we're able, and also acknowledging God's yet more, by orders of magnitude, way more enormous freedom. We are incredibly formulaic and unfree compared to the freedom of God. And so, you know, we look at patterns like, why does this person have this vision and I don't, or whatever else? Yeah. And it appears chaotic to us because we're so fettered by our sins that we can't.
But it would be oppressive if he intervened more in some ways, right? Like think of how patient and long suffering he is to let us like children find our own steps. Like you got to let your kids, you can't just bear your kids' weight in your hands the whole time. They never learn to walk, right? So you gotta let them. And that's what he does with us, right? And if he were always intervening, I mean, just think of the constant interaction with that wildness could very well kill us. Right?
Yeah. So, no, that's true.
There's a measure to things. Mm-hmm. Trust that there is.
Well. That leaves us a lot to think about. What should we do?
I don't know. Think about it.
I don't know.
What should we do, Eleni?
Something like that to wrap up. And I was like, I have no idea.
What would happen if we put Christ at the center of our thing?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I think there's some room to understand pain or any kind of illness as a process. I come back to like the organic process of those things. And versus something to be really pushed through. And I think when we understand it that way, we are able to develop the kind of compassion that God has as he watches us go through that process, right? Like, we stay in it and we develop some, I think when we stay in it in a way that's compassionate, we develop kind of the ability to feel pain for the fallen world in a way that's actually, that's deifying, right?
Yeah.
It's well, not an easy solution.
No, we don't have those. Well, this is great having you on, Eleni.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I was just going to say, you know, but I think like that is developing kind of the mind of God was the last thing I was going to say.
Mm.
And the compassion of God.
Yeah.
By your prayers. All right. Well, good night, you too.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for coming on, Eleni.
Yeah, you're so welcome.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too. Talk to you later, my friend.
Dear God, I hate to turn the tables on you, but I just mid-20s now. I need more money.